celebrate their wedding anniversary. It's a 30th wedding anniversary. And the husband had given his wife this beautiful string of pearls that she had worn very proudly to church. And she said to me somewhat sheepishly on the way out, she said, "Of all the Sundays to have that reading." Today we come face to face with a gospel lesson that really runs head on into our culture. We should not love money because it will get in the way of loving God. In the same way, Jesus teaches us that no one can be the servant of two masters, because one will serve one rather than the other. And we know this to be true, right? You can't love Richmond and Geelong. You can't love Collingwood and GWS. Well, you couldn't after this weekend anyway. More seriously, you can't love your partner and another lover. And as Jesus points out in the same vein, you can't love God and love money. Jesus' teaching on money and being a slave to it, being in love with it, being swayed by it, allured by it, shaping one's life around it, it's a hard one for us to hear. We live in a money-saturated community which promotes material well-being and indeed wealth as the be-all, end-all at every turn. It's the answer to human questions of existence and worth. Have a guess how many Australians bought a lottery ticket on Thursday night's big draw. Shaking some heads. One in three Australian adults bought a lottery ticket on Thursday night. I don't think I need to tell you that we have, in a multiplicity of ways, bought this ideal that money and wealth equals happiness, success, and no problems. Here in Toorak, one of Australia's wealthiest suburbs, one might say that what is therefore going to follow is going to be an awkward sermon at best. Or it might be my last sermon. We'll see how we go. Sometimes, perhaps like you, I forget I live where I do. We had a visitor out from Perth last year who was staying with us, and we were down in Toorak Village buying bread from Wood Frog Bakery, which I'm probably going to go into debt from the price of the bread, how good it is. I'm addicted to their bread. We're down in the village, and this person was absolutely flabbergasted at the quality of the cars parked on the side of the road in Toorak Village. We walked past lots of lovely cars, and he said, "Oh, that's right, there's a motor show on this weekend, isn't there?" And I said, "No, that's next weekend." And we walked past Mercedes after Mercedes, a Porsche, there was a Ferrari, and much to my chagrin, it was a brand new McLaren P1 parked at the end. I thought, I'd become so used to seeing these cars. In fact, I even recognise some of the cars because I know the people who own them. Ask anyone in Melbourne about Toorak and everyone's got an opinion. Tradesmen regularly quote me the Toorak price for repairs to things in the church. I tell them, don't give me the Toorak price. We're a church. Our lives here are in many ways distinguished by the money and the wealth that surrounds us. So we could ask more broadly, how did we get to this? Where in Australia, The Age published just last week, the top 1% of earners in our country own as much wealth as the bottom 70%. And there's a simple answer to this, of course, because money makes money. The more you have, the more you can earn through interest, through investment. And over time, this wealth builds up in individuals and then in families, and hey presto, here we are. But there is also a great sin here as well. That concentration of wealth in such a small set of hands is a grand holding back, a holding fast to accumulation and wealth over the enormous power that that wealth could have in transforming our culture and our community. Back to the Bible. Right throughout the Bible are teachings about the danger of the allure of money and wealth. In fact, money is referred to 800 times in the Bible. And Jesus today is just teaching one teaching in a long list of mentions. In comparison, do you know how many times sex is mentioned in the Bible? 70. While we're at it, how many times do you think does Jesus teach about sex before marriage? 0. How many times does the Bible use the word homosexuality? 0. Which is surprisingly small when you consider just how often some Christians get bent out of shape over matters of sex and sexual morality. How many times do you think refugees are referred to, or immigrants, or the alien in the land in the Bible?
Many.
Hundreds and hundreds of times. Yet too often we conveniently forget the consistent biblical imperative to care for the refugee, the immigrant, the stranger in our land. But you could be forgiven that the opposite is true. Lastly, and I'll stop these comparisons now, do you know how many white people there are in the Bible? 0. Yet we still see people, white supremacists, use the biblical text to support twisted and perverted understandings of racial worth and value. So how did we get here, such that a few verses on sex get more airplay and ire and fuss than literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of verses on the imperative to care for the poor, the sick, and the refugee? How did we get to a stage where 800 times money is mentioned in the Bible, including, I should say, a strict injunction against usury, that is, earning money through interest, which every single person here, of course, benefits from either the pension or superannuation, or if you've got money in the bank. How is it that that doesn't get any airplay? Well, it's pretty simple. Because it makes us uncomfortable. And we're pretty efficient at avoiding that which makes us uncomfortable. When was the last time you eagerly look forward to a dentist appointment? So has our avoidance of the question of money and our relation to it condemned us, one and all? And does Jesus teach that if one is wealthy, then there's no possibility of a right relationship with God either in this life or the next? Furthermore, are the high net worth people in our church community condemned for their wealth? Should we just give it all away and run for the hills? Well, here we need to listen carefully to what Jesus teaches. Jesus is concerned with the problems that come with wealth. In Matthew's gospel, he teaches a rich young man who wishes to be his disciple to give it all away and follow him. And the young man is unable to do so, and he goes away, the text tells us, mourning, grieving, for he had regret many possessions. Jesus knew this. He knew that he was obsessed with it. He couldn't give any of it away. Herein lies the key. It's not wealth that is the issue here, but it's the love of it. It's the wealth that we can't give away, that we can't see past, that, as Jesus warns, we have a love for it greater than we have for the love of God. On the front cover of our order of service this morning is a painting by Evelyn Morgan. It's of a woman embracing the god Mammon. Remember, the translation used to be, "You cannot serve God and Mammon." She is on her knees. She is paying obeisance, and she hugs to herself the god that dangles a bag of money over her head. I'm hoping and praying none of us here have a similar embrace of Mammon. So what then are we to do, people who are wealthy? It is, of course, very simple, and it's been simple for a long time. We just need to be generous with our wealth, just as God has been generous with us. God gave us all of this in the first place. Of course, we couldn't exist without God, and we literally would have nothing. We would be nothing if God hadn't created all of this in the first place. Because the model of God, remember, is to give, to create, to give life. Imagine for a second if it were the opposite, that God kept everything to God's self. None of this, you and me included, would be here. We encounter this generosity at Holy Communion, at the Eucharist, where Christ gives of his very self, his body and his blood, as in part a model of generosity. In being as generous as God is generous, and having a generous outlook in life, generous to other people, one can literally become like God, a life giver. Can we, with what we have, be that life giver? Or shall we be known for being the opposite? On that, let me say this. We celebrate a lot of lives here at St. John's, through funerals and through memorial services. We've had 15 since the beginning of August alone. And let me tell you that there is not one single person who is praised for being a miser. I never hear the following. Oh, Rick, he was such a nice guy. Every time you went to the pub, he never ever bought you a beer. Such a great guy. He was terrific. He never had you over. He never cooked for you. He never took you on his boat. He never gave you gifts. He never remembered your birthday. Fabulous fellow. Even better, Rick never gave anything to anyone else. Didn't give to anyone who was in need. Didn't give to the poor. Didn't give to the hungry. Didn't give to the homeless. Didn't give a cent to his church. What a fabulous guy. Funnily enough, I never hear that. Because the opposite, of course, is true. We are rightly praised for what we give in life. Not just financial means, but our love, our skills, our means. Life is not measured by what we keep, what we hold to ourselves, but what we give. People measure how loving someone is by how much love they give, not how much they withhold. Hence, as Jesus points out, if one is faithful in a little, one is faithful in much. If you love a little, you're likely to love a lot. If you give someone a little something to help them get by, you're also likely, if you're able to give others a lot to help them get by. Our life is measured by what we give, not what we withhold. As you should know by now, this month is our stewardship month. And each of us are asked to prayerfully consider our support of our church. And an envelope with literally your name on it is at the back of the church, which I hope you will take. What can we give to the life of the church here to keep providing the gifts of faith and hope and love that so many desperately need? What can we do with the gifts God has given us to advance the kingdom of God here in Turek? What can we give to make sure our church continues to grow as it does? These are not only questions each of us must ask ourselves as faithful stewards of our wonderful church, its mission and its ministry, but also more fundamentally. What can we give? What can I give of myself in the service of God? How can I be a giver of life for others? And what can I give in return, in response to the overwhelming generosity of God to me? A God who literally gives of God's self, of God's Son, who gives me life in this realm and in the next.